Welcome to A Good Night for Our Murder, a Victorian true crime podcast. My name is Kim, and we are still currently between seasons. So I have another Victorian society roundup for you. If you're new or haven't listened in a while, before I get into the specific case for each episode, I like to share a Victorian society tip. It's usually something related to the case I'm about to cover or has something to do with the time of year, and they can be anything from Victorian etiquette to traditions to advice articles and so on. So tonight's episode is a second compilation episode of season one's Victorian society tips. My dear friend Haley is back with me for this episode, and I hope you enjoy it. On to some Victorian society tips. A Good Night for a Murder is a true crime podcast that does cover stories including death, violence, sexual assault, and other adult themes. Please take care while listening. Tonight's tip is about how not to get body snatched. Body snatching, by which I mean having your body dug up and stolen from your grave, was a real concern in the Victorian era. And most of the perpetrators guilty of this ghoulish practice were medical students. If not the medical students themselves, the acts were carried out by men known as resurrectionists. Medical schools would pay resurrectionists to supply them with a steady stream of fresh cadavers because otherwise, how are their students going to learn? It is for the greater good, I suppose, but no one wants their loved one dug up. If this is a concern you share as well, you might be interested in grave torpedoes. The following is an 1881 ad from the Howell Grave Torpedo Company of Circleville, Ohio, for their patented grave torpedo. It's essentially a landmine that is triggered when anyone messes with the coffin. The Howell Grave Torpedo Company of Circleville, Ohio, are now manufacturing and offering to the public the only perfect protection for the bodies of the deceased friends after burial. The Howell Grave Torpedo is an article demanded by the public. It is simple, it is quickly and safely adjusted, and it is a sure preventative against body snatching. In consequence of the great number of medical colleges all over the country, together with the facilities for shipping bodies from almost every point, grave robbing has become of alarming frequency, and the horrible business of ghouls has become very profitable. Resurrectionists are required to perform their work speedily, rarely if ever removing the coffin from the grave. They generally dig down at the head of the coffin, and after breaking through or removing the lid, they fasten a strong hook under the chin and by means of a rope drag the body through the opening. After refilling the grave, they place the body in a sack, throw it into some sort of vehicle from which it is rapidly transferred to the pickling vat of some medical college for dissection. DJ Bach is sole agent for Marion, Hancock, Madison, and Hamilton counties and has on exhibition and for sale at the furniture store of Reynolds & Son in Noblesville samples of the above torpedo. He is ready now to adjust them in graves, and all parties interested are requested to call. So what do you think? You gonna invest in a grave torpedo?
I don't think that digging up graves is actually a modern problem.
Fair.
But there is still like a illegal body trade for like this kind
of... Oh, for sure.
There's a funeral home that got in trouble for illegally selling their loved one's bodies to... you know, medical facilities.
And the owner just disappeared. She just, like, walked one day and they couldn't find her, right? Is that the story?
Yeah, I mean, I think eventually, you know, they caught up with her.
So that person, and they do exist out there, was looking to profit and make money. And so were these resurrectionists.
Right.
But they were supplying the medical students, which had no other way to learn about the human body than to open it up. I know it's, like, unpleasant, but... Like I said, it was, like, for the greater good, right?
I mean, right? It was, but do you, was there an option at that time to donate your body to science, or was this the only means of...
Maybe there were fringe cases of it, but usually they donated the bodies of convicted criminals, but there wasn't enough for the amount of medical students who needed to study them, which is why these resurrectionists became a thing, which is why... the ad that I read also became a thing, was to prevent the body snatching. Basically, they were just like landmines. They weren't super reliable and probably didn't work out very well. In tonight's story, you'll hear about how a young girl was swept off her feet by a handsome new stranger who comes to town. Unfortunately, as you might have already guessed, it goes badly for her. So it got me wondering, how else is someone to meet their spouse in the Victorian era? And I started reading about lonely heart ads, or matrimonial advertisements as they were known then. They placed personal ads in the newspapers, just like us. If you're not familiar with personal ads, matrimonial advertisements could also be described as a Victorian version of a dating site profile. People would place an ad in the newspaper with a little info about themselves and what they were seeking and wait for responses. It took a lot longer, of course, but they were a thing. Here are three matrimonial advertisements for your enjoyment. First one, a bill for a wife. Charles Warren, Warnhill, Dorset. My family is as follows. The eldest boy is 13 years old. The younger boy is 5 years old and a girl 8 years old. My house is my own and I have no rent to pay. I have an acre of potatoes, half blue and half whites this year. My wife has been dead 13 months ago, last Shroton Fair. The children live with themselves in the daytime, but I am always at home with them at night. I do think it would be better if there was a woman to look after them, both for the children and myself. I have got 8 shillings a week for my work and the boy 2 shillings a week and have constant employ. I want a good and steady woman between 30 and 40 years old for a wife. I do not want a second family. I want a woman to look after the pigs while I'm out at work. I don't think he was referring to his children as pigs at the end there, but one can never be sure. On to bachelor number 2. A very pretty little boy, age 1.5 years, who has had the misfortune to lose his dear mama, wishes in this manner, as he seldom comes in contact with the ladies, to find a new mama who, however, must also be capable by tenderness and delicacy of sentiment of affording a faithful companion for life for his papa. My papa is an architect who fills an important social position, therefore I am unfortunately obliged, beside delicacy of sentiment, to look out for some fortune, so that my papa may be content with my new mama in every respect. So, bachelor number 1 or bachelor number 2, who are you choosing? The last ad is from a lady this time. A young girl, 17 years of age, who knows how to make a good soup, desires to marry someone, no matter who, and would not object to a person with a broken leg. I feel like this one is directed at someone specific who was just not getting the hint. Good luck out there, everyone. Bachelor number 1 or number 2? Which one are you picking?
Oh, definitely number 1.
Number 1. Why?
Yeah. His children are a little bit older. I don't want to raise your child their whole life. That's just me. I mean, pigs sound fun, depending on what they're...
You think he meant literal pigs, right? Like, it's
farmer. Yes, okay. I like animals.
They're cute, right. I think pigs are cute, too.
Pigs. And then number 2, while I understand kind of what he was going for, I didn't like was writing the ad from the perspective of his child. That was just, like, a little creepy for me. Just not my type.
As we get closer to Halloween and the veil between worlds starts to thin, I wanted to share some of the superstitions Victorians held that maybe you'll think of trying out this season yourself. You know, just in case. Always cover your mouth while yawning so your spirit doesn't escape and leave room for the devil to enter. Hold your breath while going by a graveyard, otherwise you will not be buried at the time of your own passing. Plant yellow flowers in the garden to protect your family from witches. A dog howling at night when someone in the house is sick is a bad omen. It can be reversed by reaching under the bed and turning over a shoe. Speaking of shoes, never place new shoes on a table. It will lead to the death of the wearer within a year. Don't open an umbrella indoors or someone in your family will die. Don't speak ill of the dead. They will come back to haunt you. If a funeral procession is approaching, turn around to avoid bad luck. If this is impossible, hold on to a button until the funeral procession has passed. If someone in your home dies, turn over family photos face down so that the dearly departed cannot possess any of the subjects in the photo. Also, stop the clocks at the time of the deceased's passing in order to avoid your own untimely death. If someone dies in your home, cover all mirrors in the house to prevent the spirit of the deceased from hiding there. Do so carefully, though, because the next person who sees a reflection in the mirror will be the next to die. If several deaths occur in the same family, tie a black ribbon to everything left alive that enters the house, even dogs and chickens. This will protect against deaths spreading further. Happy Halloween, everyone.
Like, who thought of tying a black ribbon around every single chicken that enters your house?
Close your doors.
Ward off death. Like, I don't, like, where does that even come from?
I think often about the covering and uncovering of the mirrors, specifically that the next person who looks in the mirror is going to be the one to die, because somebody's going to have to eventually uncover those mirrors.
But, like, where did you get that notion in your head that, like, that's what would befall the next person to look in the mirror? Like,
covering the mirrors, part of the superstition was that the spirit could be confused and go into the mirror and, like, look back at the living and as such tempt the living into the next life with them. In tonight's episode, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of nursing. So I wanted to share some rules from an 1887 nursing job description. Daily sweep and mop the floors of your ward, dust the patient's furniture and windowsills. Maintain an even temperature in your ward by bringing in a scuttle of coal for the day's business. Light is important to observe the patient's condition. Therefore, each day, fill kerosene lamps, clean chimneys, and trim wicks. The nurse's notes are important in aiding your physician's work. Make your pens carefully. You may whittle nubs to your individual taste. Each nurse on day duty will report every day at 7 a.m. and leave at 8 p.m., except on the Sabbath, on which day she will be off from 12 noon to 2 p.m. Graduate nurses in good standing with the director of nurses will be given an evening off each week for courting purposes, or two evenings a week if you go to church regularly. Each nurse should lay aside from each payday a goodly sum of her earnings for her benefits during her declining years, so that she will not become a burden. For example, if you earn $30 a month, you should set aside $15. Any nurse who smokes, uses liquor in any form, gets her hair done at a beauty shop, or frequents dance halls will give the director of nurses good reason to suspect her worth, intentions, and integrity. The nurse who performs her labors and serves her patients and doctors faithfully and without fault for a period of 5 years will be given an increase by the hospital administration of 5 cents per day.
This sounds very much like the a mix between the maid and the teacher rules.
Mm-hmm. Nurses seem to have a little bit more freedom. They're allowed to go courting.
Are they allowed to get married, though? Because what is this about setting aside their money so that they're not a burden? Wouldn't their husbands then take care of them in that society?
I can't recall the year that these rules are from. Maybe we got more progressive by the time these nursing rules were read. I don't think I would have wanted to be a teacher or a nurse.
Those were probably the only two jobs open for you. Like, I mean, really. No. It was probably the best paying positions.
I think I would have been like a housemaid or like a domestic servant or something. I probably would have been a lazy one, but
that wouldn't have fly. You know, you have to have the fire at 6 a.m. and everything dusted by 8.
Where I live in the northeastern U.S., we are about to head into the winter months, so I thought it would be an appropriate time to share a few tips on how Victorians kept warm during the colder weather. The first tip is dress in layers. Women could wear the same dresses year-round, but adding layers both underneath and on top was the first line of defense as temperatures dropped. Women wore stockings of cotton or silk, multiple pairs if necessary, wool pantalettes. Pantalettes are those like split bloomers that a woman wears under her skirts. A wool chemise, which we would probably describe as a full-length slip, and her corset. This is the undergarment layer. Outer layers consisted of extra wool or flannel petticoats, then their usual dress or gown. Cloaks were preferred over coats as the more practical choice to allow for poofy dress sleeves, as those were fashionable during the time. They were made of wool, silk, or velvet and varied in length from waist to knee length and came with or without hoods. Add tall boots, gloves, a hat, and a muff, and it was not uncommon that a Victorian woman could be wearing nearly 40 pounds of clothes before all was said and done. Men would also trade lighter fabrics for heavier ones like wool. Cravats were not just fashionable, they helped keep necks warm. They wore tall leather boots and gloves, often fur-lined. Long coats and the Iverness cape was a very popular choice. That's the short cape that covers the man's shoulders that Sherlock Holmes is often depicted wearing. And if they could afford it, both men and women wore fur and animal skins to keep warm, and they did not spare any animal. The second tip is how to decorate your home for warmth. Heavy drapes obviously blocked drafts and kept warmth in, but many Victorians would line their walls with tapestries, which were not only beautiful, but were literally being used to insulate their walls. Third tip, utilize your foot warmers and bed warmers. Foot warmers could be moved from room to room and were made of porcelain, ceramic, or metals. They would be filled with hot coals or sometimes boiling water. Similarly, copper bed warmers would be filled with hot coals and slid over sheets like an iron before bedtime to warm one's bed before climbing in. Speaking of beds, we think of canopy beds as luxurious and dramatic, but in Victorian times, they were more practical. Canopies and drapes helped keep warmth in while sleeping. The fourth tip is to get cozy. It's well known that most Victorian homes could very well have a fireplace in each room of the house, but even in wealthy families, it wasn't uncommon to find the master and mistress of the house gathered around the hearth with their servants in wintertime, taking full advantage of the largest and coziest fire in the house, plus conserving all of their body heat to one room. Likewise, it wasn't uncommon for family members to snuggle up in bed together at night to stay warm. So, grab a friend, grab a pet, and stay safe and warm this season, friends. I think this is all excellent advice.
I'm just thinking about those poor women wearing 40 pounds of clothes. That seems like...
Right.
Can you imagine having to undress at night?
Like, well, you wouldn't want to. It was so cold. You and I can get in our car and turn on the heat, and we know that when we get wherever we're going, it's going to be warm in there. But, like, can you imagine never walking into anywhere warm in the winter?
Yeah.
Sounds terrible.
But so does putting on 40 pounds of clothes.
Well, you know what? They didn't go very many places in the winter. Especially,
but even in your own home, if all you have to keep warm is fireplaces and tapestries,
that's
it's
true.
You're probably still wearing 40 pounds of clothes.
I know, you better bundle up. I do want a canopy bed. Did you ever have a canopy bed, Miss Kim?
No.
No, did you want one?
Kinda.
Definitely. I did too. It is officially the holiday season, and since the past few cold, flu, and COVID seasons may have kept you away from visiting friends and family, I wanted to share some Victorian tips on how to be a good party guest. First, do not arrive more than 10 to 15 minutes early. Likewise, do not arrive too late. As one writer advised, I have always been punctual to the hour of dinner, for I know that those whom I kept waiting would employ those unpleasant moments to sum up all of my faults. In other words, if you're not there, people will talk about you, especially if you hold up dinner, apparently. Now, you can expect the gentleman in the house to escort the most honored lady to the dinner table, determined either by age or status, and the most distinguished gentleman of the guests will escort the lady of the house. It is not likely that you and your own spouse will enter the dining room together. The lady of the house will pair you up according to something, status, I suppose. And don't expect to sit with your spouse or your business colleagues at dinner. The goal is for the entire table to engage in light, interesting conversation, and if you sit too near someone you know too well, you'll only talk to them. So the rule is, if there are place cards, sit where you find your name. Otherwise, sit as far away from your spouse as possible. Ladies take their seats first. Gentlemen, be mindful not to step on the dresses of any of the ladies. We do not have enough time tonight to cover the extensive list of Victorian table manner rules, but here's a crash course to get you through. Don't ask for seconds. Talk to the staff and servers as little as possible. Never find fault with the food. Everything is wonderful, even if it's burnt. Use your napkin and silverware properly. Don't do anything weird like stretch or lean back in your chair or anything like that. Now, when the dinner and dessert is finished, the hostess will, quote, catch the eye of the principal among them, meaning the most distinguished female guest. And again, quote, an interchange of ocular telegraphing takes place. Then the hostess rises, and with her, all the company rise. In some traditions, the ladies depart for the drawing room, where they'll later be joined by the men. In some circles, this is considered a sign of low breeding, and the men will accompany the women to the drawing room at the same time. From 2 to 3 hours after dinner is the proper time to leave the house. And finally, within 1 week, pay a brief dinner call to express thanks to your host and hostess and to briefly reminisce over the delights of the evening. Do not stay for less than 10 minutes or more than 20. The one burning question I tried so hard to answer while researching this, though, was should you bring a hostess gift? But unfortunately, I found no concrete answer, leading me to believe that the host and hostess gifts are more of a modern tradition inspired by consumerism, probably. But I did learn that gift-giving during the holidays was not a widespread tradition until about the 1870s, at which time gifts were placed unwrapped in the branches of a Christmas tree. So, if you want to give a host or hostess gift like a Victorian, think small. Think handmade, like doilies, picture frames, trinket boxes, fans, jewelry. Also, cigars or cigarette cases were popular. Also, perishable foods like flowers or food, particularly jams, jellies, or candies. Friends, I hope you stay healthy and spend lots and lots of time with your loved ones this season. So the introvert in me really loved this Victorian society tip. I really wish I had a etiquette manual to tell me when to arrive and to leave a party. I would really love that.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like the only part of this that I kind of disagree with is not being able to ask for seconds, but that's like the fatty in me. Other than that, I kind of appreciate it.
Well, to be honest, if your hostess was not providing enough for you to like just freely take your seconds, I mean, that was on them.
Yeah.
I also love that it was literally written into the etiquette that the hostess would kind of like side-eye her bestie for when dinner was about to be over. Like, you and I literally did that.
I like that.
like,
you ready? Give me the eyes.
Yes. Kind of. right. Like, this is done. Like, and then we all stand and we move along. What do you think of the, like, Christmas gift giving tradition? I think we should bring most of this back. Also, like, the small gifts, right? Like, in the tree. Like, and homemade gifts, right?
Yeah. As I get older, every single year, I'm out of ideas. I'm so anti-consumerism. I try to do the absolute bare minimum I can get away with. So, yeah.
Agreed. Like, consumable gifts? Great idea.
Yes.
I think a lot of people would agree with you. During the Christmas holiday season, a favorite pastime of Victorians was telling ghost stories. But where did that tradition come from? Well, the winter months in Victorian England were long, dark, and cold. They were made up of long evenings gathered around the fire without any other form of entertainment. All families and friends had was one another to keep themselves company, shut inside dark homes, save for the firelight, surrounded by the even darker night outside. Also, the holiday of Christmas wasn't the merry, jolly holiday it is today. Many Christmas traditions are inspired by the pagan festival of Yule, which begins on the winter solstice, December 21st, and lasts for 12 nights. This was regarded as a time when the veil between the worlds of the living and dead was thin. And Yule in particular actually celebrates the returning of the sunlight as days start to get longer and longer again from that day forward. So it's a time that's very symbolic of returning, things coming back. And remember, the veil is thin. What exactly do you think is likely to come back? So these traditions, coupled with the fact that people had very little else to do, sitting around in dark rooms where winter weather very well might isolate them from the rest of the outside world for some time, really brewed up the perfect environment for ghost stories. Initially, stories were passed along by word of mouth, but by about the 1830s to 1840s, the Industrial Revolution really took off in Britain, and the distribution of ghost stories was helped along by advancements in the printing industry. It became cheaper to print and publish all sorts of things, thereby making the publications more affordable to buy and more accessible to working and middle classes. Also, the literacy rates were increasing during this time. So, if you're looking to celebrate the Christmas season like a Victorian, wait until night, turn off all of your lights, light some candles, and gather some friends for a good old-fashioned ghost storytelling. Happy holidays, everyone. What do you think of ghost stories as a holiday tradition?
It just made me think of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, mm-hmm. how that was very focused on ghost stories. Mm-hmm. Like, is that related?
Yes. Yeah, it is. I can't remember the year that it was published. It really kind of captured the sentiment of the time, like, as far as Christmas. Imagine being, like, stuck inside, like, a farmhouse where it's quiet and creaky and windy and dark.
Part of me kind of romanticizes that, but living it would probably be a different story.
I know, like, you were, like, probably, you know, they were worried about making it through the winter, like a lot of people then. The same in, like, an English country manor, like,
true,
same. That's the part that I romanticize that I want to go back to. Tonight's tip is how to celebrate the New Year's like a Victorian. Now, the Victorians would use any excuse to be spooky, so one popular tradition for New Year's Eve parties were known as phantom balls. Guests would dress up in ghostly costumes and partake in a bit of divination, such as reading tea leaves, in an effort to see what the year ahead held. When the clock struck 12 on New Year's Eve, partygoers would rush to the front door, fling it wide open, and yell welcome to the new year. Then it was customary for the head of the household to throw a cake against the front door to ensure a year without hunger. They're already wasting a whole cake, so I don't understand this one, but sounds like a hell of a party, right? Also, the first person who crossed the threshold into the home after midnight would set the tone for the whole rest of the year, so it was important for it to be someone who was considered lucky and trustworthy. Bonus points if they brought a gift and if they were a dark-haired man. If it was a blonde man, though, that was unlucky, so send them around to the servant's entrance or something. It was important to clean out all the fireplace hearths in the house on New Year's Eve, as this was symbolic of sweeping away anything undesirable from the past year and starting with a clean slate. Now, the next morning, upper-class Victorian men would spend New Year's Day going from house to house visiting with the eligible bachelorettes. They would spend 15 minutes or so visiting before moving on to the next home. It was the Victorian version of speed dating, you could say. It was also important to always wear a brand new set of clothes on New Year's Day to symbolize a fresh start. And additionally, it was important to go around with a bit of money in your pocket all day to ensure wealth in the following year. I hope everyone has a safe, happy, and healthy New Year. Do you recognize any of these traditions?
No, but I'm still upset about the cake.
I agree. The part where they would, like, throw open the door at New Year's Eve, though, like, did you ever go outside on New Year's Eve and, like, Happy New Year?
Not my family personally, but, like, I would hear, like, neighbors sometimes, like, going out and, like, banging pots and pans.
Yeah, my mom and I would do that. We, like, would ring bells and stuff. We would do that.
No, we were never that into it.
You're right.
Pretty low-key.
It's over. Do you think you would, like, want to be up on New Year's Day receiving, like, gentlemen callers?
I mean, it depends on how the night before went and how I'm feeling. Maybe.
So this fell out of favor because gentlemen were not being genuine about their interest in the ladies they were visiting. They really just wanted to, like, go and get a bunch of snacks at all, like, the fine houses. So this kind of fell out of favor for New Year's parties that you need an invitation to.
Yeah, I can see that.
In 1899, American drug manufacturer Merck & Company published its first edition of the Merck Manual of Diagnosis and Therapy. Now in its 20th edition, the Merck Manual remains the world's best-selling medical textbook. Of course, we know a lot more about medicine today than we did back in 1899. So, I wanted to share some advice from the manual's first publication, just to see how far we've come. First up, arsenic. Victorians use arsenic for everything. In the 1899 Merck Manual, it's recommended as the treatment for everything from anthrax to syphilis to anemia. People would ingest it, inhale it, inject it, put it on their skin, and the side effects were rashes, stomach distress, and headaches. Plus, if you've listened to at least one or two episodes of this podcast, and honestly, even if you haven't, you probably know about the side effect of death from arsenic poisoning. Another dreadful treatment recommended by the manual is laxatives to treat pretty much any kind of eruptive fever, meaning a fever with a rash, such as chickenpox, smallpox, or scarlet fever. Can you imagine trying to combat smallpox with laxatives? Anyway, it didn't work. It just gave people a whole new set of problems to deal with on top of being very sick already. Next is strychnine. If you're a fan of true crime, particularly older true crime, you've undoubtedly heard of strychnine poisoning. But in 1899, it was recommended as treatment for constipation. It was thought to help with all sorts of stomach ailments, including gas and ulcers. They also recommended chloroform for curing the hiccups. I mean, if you can't breathe, you can't hiccup, I guess, so they weren't wrong. If you have asthma, the manual states smoking is sometimes beneficial, recommending the use of cannabis and indica for chronic asthma, as well as other herbs like stramonium, hallucinogen-inducing nightshade, or lobelia, which was known for its sedative properties. I'm not a doctor, but don't smoke if you have asthma, please. Other treatments for calming problems included belladonna for colic in babies, leeches for earaches, which actually had some almost sound science behind it, and cocaine for alcoholism. Listen, I'm not saying we know all there is to know or that we always get it right when it comes to medical diagnosis and treatments, even today. I am glad, though, that they are no longer prescribing arsenic, strychnine, and cocaine as medications now. Arsenic again.
I mean, I don't think much has truly changed. Every single drug commercial that you see has a laundry list of side effects. Most of the time, they sound worse than the original thing you're treating in the first place.
I agree. I think that we are not very different in our thinking now from the thinking then, as far as you will get this benefit and there will be these risks and side effects associated. But I think where we do differ is that I think that we are able to better measure the effectiveness of the prescriptions that we have these days. And I think that is like the key difference between now and 1899.
Earlier this month, we talked about Dr. Crippen, who was the first murderer caught through the aid of wireless telegraphy. Tonight, we're going to talk about the first murder solved with fingerprint evidence. The Victorian era paved the way for all sorts of innovations in transportation, communication, and medicine alike. It saw the first use of electric lighting, the telephone, underground railway systems, the x-ray, the bicycle, anesthesia. But there were some inventions that were used for the first and last time during the Victorian era, such as the fence cycle, which looked sort of like a bicycle, except the wheels were up by the handlebars and seat, which allowed you to essentially ride along fence railings. They also invented the Niagara wave and rocking bath, which promoted the idea that bathing in moving water, such as oceans and rivers, was good for circulations and arthritis and digestion. It was kind of like a giant bathtub-sized rocking chair that was meant to be filled with water and used indoors. Another invention was the gentleman's multi-purpose cane, which was a walking cane that could be converted to a butterfly catching net, an umbrella, a flute, an opium pipe, a horse measurer, and probably more. They also got really into electromagnetism, particularly what they called animal magnetism, which was the idea that all living things' bodies contained a magnetic fluid that could be used to influence health. It's from this concept that inventors came up with things like the electric hairbrush or the electric corset. Now, when I read about these, I thought these were somehow literally using electricity to deliver like tiny electrical shocks or something. But no, that's not what this is. When Victorians referred to the electric hairbrush or electric corset, they just meant it was made with really strong magnets embedded in it, which they thought was controlling this magnetic fluid to flow more correctly throughout your body. They made the claims that such products could help with constipation, malarial lameness, rheumatism, blood diseases, and even paralysis. One ad for an electric corset read that they were, quote, the very thing for ladies young or old, especially those who suffer from weak back, chills, rheumatism, hysteria, internal complaints, loss of appetite, nervous dyspepsia,
kidney disorders, rheumatic and organic affections, ladies' ailments, biliousness, etc. Wow, all that, so easy to cure. But wait, there's more. By wearing this perfectly designed corset, the most awkward figure becomes graceful and elegant, the internal organs are speedily strengthened, and the chest is aided in healthy development. So none of those inventions ever took off. But if you had to back one of them, which one would you pick?
Oh, definitely the multi-purpose cane.
Right?
That doesn't sound like a terrible idea.
I agree. Yeah. Yeah, I think with the right market. I mean, they tried to make it be all things to all people, but I think if they just, like, reined it in just, like, a little bit, that they would have hit the right audience. I would like to try out the, like, rocking wave bath.
I don't hate that idea. That no. seems relaxing. Like, maybe mm-hmm. it would, you know, psychosomatically help some of your issues.
I don't think it would, but I think it sounds like fun. I think it would make like a mess. I don't use it indoors, but why not?
Well, maybe in like a specific facility designed for that.
Like, you know what? I feel like there probably still are a lot of products that use magnets and magnetism.
There is. I feel like that was like a thing, like
still around.
Yeah, like 20 or so years ago, there were like bracelets people would wear.
Oh,
like,
that's right. That's right. You are not wrong about that. I agree. You know what? They were onto something. I hope you enjoy that little roundup, friends. If you want to listen to the full episodes for those tips, I put a directory in the episode blog on my website that you can find at agoodnightforamurder.com. While you're on the website, you can also sign up for the monthly newsletter or learn more about the Patreon benefits. You can also follow me on Instagram or TikTok at agoodnightforamurder. Full episodes will resume again in May. Until then, thank you for listening, and I will talk to you again soon.